From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the Ring of Fire Studios. My great thanks to Mike Papantonio, Scott Milliken, and all the other great folks here in Florida that always, I mean always, make us feel so welcome. It's Thanksgiving weekend, and so we also give thanks for each and every listener who has made a contribution to keep State of Belief Radio on the air. This program is made possible in great part by your generous support. November 29th is Giving Tuesday, an annual event when many charities and nonprofit organizations explicitly ask for support. You'll be hearing more about that on this week's show. But for more information on how you can help keep us going strong in a very challenging time, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Christian season of Advent begins on November 27th and continues until Christmas Day. The 27th is also the Baha'i observance of the Ascension of Abdu'l-Bahá. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, a major alt-right conference in the heart of Washington, D.C., drew hundreds of supporters eager to promote a new ethno-state for white people. Shamefully, most of the gathered press left soon after a sugar-coated press conference. It's only thanks to the Atlantic magazine capturing video of the closing remarks that we know what really happened. And so do the over 40 million people that have viewed the Atlantic's video online so far.
Hail Trump! Hail our people! Hail victory!
I think we'll just say that's the story of the week this week and leave it at that. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Intimidation and harassment has grown dramatically nationwide. From a Maryland church to a billboard in California, the number of hate crime incidents doubling since last Friday. Many, but not all, of the incidents making reference to Donald Trump.
What can't be denied is a well-documented surge in acts of hate and even violence, clearly targeting people based on criteria including religious faith. Defending true faith and freedom, regardless of who's in the White House, has been the mandate of Interfaith Alliance since its founding. But the work is more urgent and is likely to impact individual lives more today than ever. You'll get a Giving Tuesday briefing from Alliance President Jack Moline.
The outcome of this year's UN climate talks were never going to rival the global agreement made last year in Paris, but it was hoped progress would be made in a few key areas. The election of Donald Trump, who has called climate change a hoax as the next US president, has cast a shadow over these talks, but it didn't stop the US delegation from trying to push forward in the hope that they can lock in any gains before a change of administration.
It's not climate change, it's climate chaos. That headline on a recent Religion Dispatches column summarizes the Reverend Donna Scopper's impressions of the United Nations Climate Conference that she just attended in Marrakesh, Morocco. Donna's back, and we'll get more details of the experience on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
video and still photos taken Sunday show the clash between police and protesters attempting to stop construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Over 500 tribes from across America showed up to it. It's been the largest gathering of Indian people in the modern history.
Clyde Bellacourt, founder of the American Indian Movement, says police are using violence against peaceful protesters.
This is un-American, what we're doing to the native people.
A much more immediate and dramatic confrontation over natural resources and human rights has been playing out right here in our own country. With far less press coverage than it deserves, the battle between local and federal law enforcement on the one hand and Native American activists and advocates on the other has boiled over into bloody violence. Militarized police have employed unconscionable tactics against peaceful demonstrators, leading to numerous injuries and, it now appears, even the loss of a limb for one young woman. Joining me right now is Leanne Eastman, a member of the Sisseton Wahpeton Sioux tribe, who has been on the front lines of this shameful conflict. Leanne, thank you so much for making time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Yes.
Please let me say how very sorry I am at what's happening to your community. Would you start with just a very brief summary of how the conflict started and how long it's been going on?
Yes, people started to first gather in around February of this year, and there was only a handful of people. They started to camp on the land, and from there, they started to receive support. From there, it was still like a handful, 10, 15 people holding it down until they actually started bringing bulldozers and things in. That was like at the end of July. It started to get crazy, so people started to come. That's around the time that I came. I've been at the camp now for 3.5 months.
Leanne, tell us what it's like around you. What do you see as you look around where you are now?
Well, the camp is just beautiful, especially right now there, because, of course, it's Native Month, and I know a lot of, right now, people are trying to celebrate this holiday, but at the camp, of course, we're calling it the Thanksgiving, and then this is going on in Standing Rock, so it's beyond me.
Last Sunday saw terrible violence directed at the demonstrators. Would you talk about what happened last Sunday?
Yeah, you're talking about the night of the water, the freezing water, the sound cannons, or the sound gurneys, or whatever. I don't even know the correct terms for all these things. Yeah, that went on, I would say, for over 24 hours. It started around in the evening, and it just progressed on into the next day, into the afternoon, and I think the evening. People at the bridge, I saw a lot of people up there with the peaceful demonstration, you know, and were protectors. You know, I got tear gassed. Those rubber bullets, when they shot them at the crowd, I was right in there in the vicinity of all of that, and it was scary. I couldn't hear. I couldn't take a deep breath. I was running. I couldn't see. It was scary. I was like, this is exactly like a war zone. Mm-hmm. And then for them to be spraying cold water on people.
Has the situation changed in the days since those harsh attacks?
No, it's the same. I think that every day that goes by, it's getting worse and worse. I can tell you that I don't sleep well at night. A lot of people don't, and a lot of people don't even sleep well at all. A lot of people are in the same boat as me. You know, sometimes a gunshot, sometimes, you know, you can hear the sound cannon. One night there was a fire started. Like, I don't know if that was to intimidate us, but it was all burning towards the camp. No fire department was deployed. This fire was burning for like several hours, 4, 5, 6 hours. You never know when something's going to happen. It could happen 3 o'clock in the morning or at noon. You don't know. It's like a literal war zone. Like helicopters and planes flying over the camp 24 hours a day, especially at night. These planes and helicopters are flying over the camp illegally with no lights on. And it's kind of strange after they're flying over the camp that there's a heavy smell of gas or some sort of, I don't know what it is that they're spraying, but you could smell it, and it's really, really obvious that it's coming from these planes with no lights on that are flying over the camp at night. And there's several people here that are sick, including me, that I got sick with pneumonia. People's asthma is flaring, rashes, virus. People are getting infections and ending up in the hospital. It's not right. They think that they can do whatever they want to us. And whatever they do, they'll just go on the news and they'll do a press conference and they'll talk about, for instance, oh, we were spraying water on them because there was a lot of fires. We got to put them out. That's what they said. And everybody believes them, but the videos, the live streams that you can see on Facebook clearly show that they're spraying people just to spray them for hours. No fires. So they lie. They straight up lie. The police department lies. You know, these people in North Dakota think they could do whatever they want to Native Americans because they've been doing that for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've had enough. We're not going to take it anymore. We're going to do whatever we can peacefully to stop this because everybody deserves clean drinking water. Everybody. Mm-hmm. It's not about color. It's not about race or how you fall in politically or anything like that. I don't understand how people don't think about their children and their grandchildren and their children. What are they going to drink? I think we're living in a very, very scary time, and this is a war zone in the state of North Dakota, in treaty territory. This land rightfully belongs to the Ojibwe-Shakowee. Ratified treaty. They need to remember that.
Leanne, given the terrible conditions that you're having to endure, what is it that's keeping you and other activists and allies from giving up?
Because our ancestors prayed for us 7 generations ago. They knew this was coming. They talked about the black snake that was going to come, and they prayed for the strength for 7 generations down that we would be able to endure this. And if they believed in us back then, if they were praying for us back then that we would be able to handle this and kill this black snake, you know, these are my people. They're putting a pipeline through sacred burial grounds. You know, if we did that in Arlington Cemetery or, you know, any cemetery, people would be serious. Mm-hmm. You know, if we went into a church, anybody's church, their place of prayer, and demolished it, they would be mad. You know, the land is our church. This place specifically that our tribal historic preservation officers have went out, looked over this land, surveyed this land, they know that it's been a place of prayer for hundreds of years. You know, a place of gathering for our people, and they were told this. These things are here, and by law, they were supposed to go around it.
Leanne, with great respect for your religion and spirituality, I'd like for you to talk for just a minute about the teachings of Dakota spirituality that come into play here.
First and foremost, for our people, it's about family. And to us, we are all related. We're all family. Doesn't matter. It's always about family. Instead of thinking of ourselves, we think of one another. You know, that's what strengthens the community. We're all out here fighting for the water. And yes, it's because of the values that were instilled in me growing up in a very, very traditional home that gives me the strength and the courage that I need to fight to keep our water clean. A lot of people say the word Miniwatoni. The name of this Missouri is Minishoshe. That's what our people called it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very sacred, Miniwaka, very sacred water. So we have to respect that because without water, you cannot live. There's no life. Water is life, Miniwatoni. You know, I don't know how many times you have to say that over and over again, you know. And for me, as a Dakota woman, knowing that water is feminine, in our way of life, water is feminine, that's what pushes me even more to stand up there and do what I have to do because it is the first medicine. Mm. Water is the first medicine. Without water, you can't live. You can't grow food. You can't do anything. We're made up of water. People have to start understanding that. Like, it's not about if the pipeline's going to break. They all break. It's going to break, and it's going to affect our water. It's going to affect it for millions of people. We're living in a scary time, but I'm not going to back down. I'm not going to leave. And there's a lot of people here that are exactly like me, and there's more to come, and they're not going to stop coming. The size of the camp right now is bigger than I've ever seen it, and it makes me feel good. When I come out of my tent, I really, and I'm like, welcome home, you know, I'm just telling people welcome home, because at the camp, that's what it feels like, it's home. It feels comfortable, and we're at home, and maybe I don't know a lot of these tribes or these people here. I feel like my spirit knows them somehow. Hmm. They're here because the same reason why I'm here, our ancestors prayed for us to be here, to come and connect, to come and join forces and to win this battle. Just like me, there's a lot of people that are kind of backed out.
Ms. Eastman, the Obama administration has not been particularly helpful on this. What are the activists there expecting once the Trump administration comes in?
Nobody really talked about it, and they were, I think it was a big fear that set in because we know what he's about, how he feels towards people of color, the indigenous people of this land. We know how he feels towards women and towards two-spirit people. It is scary. But you know what? I've also heard from a lot of leaders at this camp, you know, especially youth leaders, that, well, our people had to endure 500 years of this so far. I mean, we can endure this guy, too. And it's just like strength and courage. And they're facing it like a buffalo with no fear, facing the storm.
Are there ways that people listening to this radio show right now, ways that they can be of help in the fight that you continue to face?
If people want to help, donations, 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 especially going towards winter. There is a main Standing Rock donation thing on Facebook, but there's also individual camps within the camp that people can donate to if they want. But, like, winter's coming, and you can be here. Your presence is number one. Prayer and donations.
Leanne Eastman is a member of the Susitun Wahpetun Sioux tribe on the front lines, defending native lands from militant aggression by law enforcement forces serving the interests of the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock, North Dakota. Leanne, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking time to be with us. Please stay safe. I don't think I've ever done an interview more tearing than what I have heard from Leanne Eastman. Every week, you hear me say that this show is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. As we celebrate Thanksgiving weekend and get ready for Giving Tuesday on November 29th, our good friend Shelley Wright was kind enough to take a few minutes to record a message sharing her reasons for supporting Interfaith Alliance.
Hi, my name is Shelley Wright. Some of you may know me as a country singer for years and years and years and years. I also happen to be the first country singer who came out of the closet as an openly gay woman. I want to talk a little bit today about Interfaith Alliance and the powerful way that the organization has affected my life and people who I've been able to be in contact with. There was a film about my coming out called Wish Me Away, in which I think it very effectively told the story of what it's like for a gay person like myself to also have a faith practice, and how those that felt very at odds with who I could be very early in my life, but now how it can very beautifully be a part of who I am. The film Wish Me Away was seen by a lot of people and won a lot of film festivals, and I'm quite proud of the way that it represented my story. I want to share with you again a couple of little tidbits about interesting ways that the film has touched people. I've met a lot of folks who have a loved one who is gay. For example, scores and scores and scores, if not hundreds or maybe even thousands of people have come to me and said, I saw Wish Me Away, and it really helped me. It enlightened me about how a person who is gay, LGBTQ, can still have a very effective faith practice. And in particular, a couple of moms have told me that, you know, we watched the film, we stumbled across it on Showtime or Netflix, and we watched the film and it inspired us to contact our gay child who had come out to us 15, 20, 25 years before, and they very sadly and very emotionally told me that they had cut their child off, really rejected their child, and the film was the impetus for their getting back in touch with their loved one. And that, and I thought, well, that is powerful in a way that I didn't even anticipate the film would be. I just thought it would comfort other people like me. But other families have found comfort in the film. And then more recently, I had a show a couple of months ago. I have a new record that came out, so I'm on tour. And my manager told me that there was a man that really desperately wanted to talk to me before the show. He wanted a meet and greet, and I said, okay, I'll meet with him. He came backstage. He was about a 52-year-old guy, Jack, and his wife, Joy. And Joy stood over in the corner, and she said, this is Jack's thing. He's been a fan of yours forever, a lifelong fan. And whenever I meet a lifelong fan who stayed with me after I came out, that's always special to me. And Jack proceeded to tell me that he didn't know he had ever really known or cared about a gay person until I came out of the closet. And he said, and I watched Wish Me Away, and I read your book, and he said it really, some things started to happen inside of my heart and in my mind and in my faith practice myself. And he said, it changed me. And I thought to myself, well, that's really great that he's sharing this with me. I had heard this type of testimonial from a lot of people. It didn't mean that it wasn't meaningful to me in that moment, but I thought that was the end of his story. And then he said, but then I have to tell you what happened. And I said, okay. And he said, a month ago I was driving our son to his freshman year of college at the University of Virginia. And he said, I was telling my son, Patrick, I'm really proud of this new endeavor for you. I just want you to know Mom and I are behind you. Anything, if you need anything while you're at school, you call us. We're here. We care about this experience for you. And if there's anything that you want to tell me now about how you're feeling, I want to know it. And he said his son was quiet for about 5 minutes and said, okay, Dad, I want to tell you that I'm gay. And Jack told me that in that moment that had he not seen the film Wish Me Away, again, which Interfaith Alliance had been a big part of, he said he had not seen that film, his son would have gotten a very, very different reaction from him on that very long car ride. And I said, what did you say to your son when he told you he's gay? He said, son, thanks for telling me. I love you. Let's talk about it. And it was really meaningful to Jack to tell me that what he saw in Wish Me Away because of Interfaith Alliance had spared him perhaps the loss of a relationship with his child, and it spared him from saying something he'd later down the road have to call his son maybe 10, 20 years ago, 10 years later, son, I'm sorry, I messed it up. The work of the Interfaith Alliance, completely just cut out what might have been a very painful portion of this father-son relationship. And because of that, this is me asking you to help celebrate and mark Giving Tuesday. This holiday season, of course, is very precious to all of us for a lot of different reasons. But please, please give something. Please make a donation to Interfaith Alliance because of the good work that they do, not just in my life, but the great, great work that they've done in Jack's life and his son Patrick and hundreds and thousands of people around the world. This money is needed to do the great work that Interfaith Alliance continues to do. So I'm asking you to give a little, give a lot. Happy holidays.
Some thoughts from country star Shelley Wright for this year's Giving Tuesday coming up on November 29th. A few weeks ago, you heard from the Reverend Donna Scopper, senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City, She talked about the reason she was going to attend the COP22 Climate Change Conference in Marrakesh, Morocco. Well, she went, and she's back, and she's just published some impressions on Religion Dispatches magazine under the headline, "It's Not Climate Change, It's Climate Chaos." And as promised, I'm happy to be able to welcome Donna Scopper back to State of Belief Radio. Donna, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
So what are your most important takeaways from this conference?
Well, it was a very good conference. Ironically, the U.S. election meant that a lot of space opened up for other environmental actors, and China really stepped up to the plate. The EU, European Union, had signs up all over the place saying we welcome non-state partners. The buzzword was sub-national groupings are the people who are going to save the climate, not nation states. So I thought there was a new kind of democracy, a new kind of democratic participation, and also leadership from Asia that emerged very organically. That was my big takeaway, that, of course, climate deniers in the White House is not my idea of a good time, nor will it help anything. But the way people immediately regrouped was very, very important and significant.
Donna, how closely aligned are the various parties around the table on this issue?
Everybody is aligned on the problem. Everybody is aligned on the Paris Accord about 1.5 degrees being too much. Where we are not aligned is who's going to pay who for what. And that is a big, huge problem. That's why these subnational groupings are working on more local solutions. For example, what's happened in New England and Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island in terms of divesting from fossil fuels and investing in renewables on a regional basis. This is the kind of thing I think is going to happen all over the globe right now. The other big learning that I had was around that language of divest and invest. You know, we often talk about divestment movements, and what people are saying is don't talk about it that way. Talk about it as divest, invest. Divest from the old stuff, leave it in the ground, and invest in renewables. And the third big takeaway was the impact of women. Women's leadership was just everywhere in this COP22, whereas in Paris, it was pretty much a guy thing going on. So I was pleased with that, too.
Sure. Did faith-inspired voices play a role in the gathering?
Yes. Bishop Andrus, the Episcopal bishop from California, was simply wonderful. I really thought he provided excellent leadership. Also, Fletcher Harper from Green Faith provided excellent leadership. There were some American religious groups. Since it was in Morocco, though, every interfaith service was 80% Muslim, and mostly Muslim women. So it was had a different feel than Paris.
Were COP22 attendees really concerned about the outcome of the U.S. election?
You know, the first day, yeah. The first day, everybody was like in, I would almost call it a state of hysteria. You couldn't have a conversation with anybody unless you said, look, I didn't vote for him, right? But then people, since it's so much more a global movement than a U.S. movement, I think I partly went for therapy just to get out of the United States and nonstop talk about elections. It was really interesting to see that people were ready to move on and really were never that convinced the United States was going to do a damn thing in the first place.
Yeah. Tell us where the important action will take place next, and tell us what we should be watching for going forward if we want to be a part of it.
I think that the important action will be in the invest-divest movement. And I would say follow the money and follow the kind of resources that travel to renewables and, frankly, stop fracking. Leave the oil that's left in the ground. This is crucial. because if that oil comes out of the ground, we won't make the 1.5 Celsius deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And that's terribly important.
So before we get off, what is your message to our listeners about this issue and where we're going and what they need to be doing?
I would say get involved. Do everything you can to support the people in Standing Rock. Write everybody you can today and call everybody you can today to support the people who are trying to stop fossil fuels in Standing Rock. It's important that that be a victory and not a defeat. And it's the strongest movement we've had yet, including the Canadian pipeline. I'm on a call every day with people out there. I just bought a teepee and some blankets to send and send money. Follow it. Get on social media. Talk it up.
The Reverend Donna Scopper is a senior minister at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. We'll link to her article on attending the UN Climate Conference in Morocco, headlined, "It's Not Climate Change, It's Climate Chaos," from stateofbelief.com. Donna, I'm glad you're back. I'm glad you briefed us. You're always good to keep us educated as we need to be. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you've been able to slow down this Thanksgiving weekend, take some time with your friends and family, and reset a little bit for the holiday season ahead. Giving Tuesday has become an important part of that season, as recent events in our nation inevitably mean that there are more Americans than ever in need of Interfaith Alliance representing them, defending their rights and standing up for their values. I'm so happy to welcome Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, back to State of Belief Radio. Jack, happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for being here.
Welton, it's good to be among friends, particularly at this moment in history.
Jack, discuss, if you would, a couple of achievements from the past year that you think more people should know about in learning about the Interfaith Alliance.
We've had a terrific year, Welton, given that we're dealing with a relatively friendly administration. We talked a lot before the election about how we would up our game, because we really had a lot of friends in the administration. We were part of an extraordinary coalition that addressed the CVE, the Countering Violent Extremism policies of the Obama administration, to try to encourage the Justice Department to call that what it was, which was Muslim profiling, and to take a better approach to working with the American Muslim community. And I'm proud to say that we had a lot of influence. We participated in a number of roundtables. The DOJ changed a lot of its definitions and a lot of its approaches. We've had tremendous success in addressing the concerns of the LGBTQ community and the challenges that they faced in individual states as they came up against a plethora of so-called Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that mostly legitimated discrimination. But I will tell you, nothing gave me greater satisfaction over the past year than what happened just over a week ago in front of Masjid Muhammad, the nation's mosque, here in Washington, D.C., where faith leaders from across the spectrum gathered and stood in front of a gaggle of representatives from all of the media and proclaimed that we would stand with the Muslim community against any kind of expression of anti-Muslim bigotry that would be forthcoming from the White House or any kind of registry or profiling that would take place. My experience has been that we can disagree with all sorts of people on the details of this policy or that policy, but when push comes to shove, we all recognize we're in this together. We all have a constitution whose values we share, whose rights we share, whose approaches to a society governed by law we share, and the relationships that I've been able to build with people across faith lines and across the lines of people with no faith at all, mm-hmm. have just been extraordinary for the betterment of the citizenry of the United States. We just brought on board our newest board member, Kyle Jones, is an atheist chaplain in Arizona. This is the first time a publicly proclaimed atheist is sitting on the board of Interfaith Alliance. It's a relationship that's important for us to develop because Kyle has an extraordinary sensitivity to people of faith and a mission to help them understand that we still share a common morality, common values, even if he himself isn't a theist.
Let's move from that to talk about a couple of challenges, in particular things you'd like to be doing right now if you had more resources available to do the work.
Our new development director, Michelle Mallett, who's terrific, came in after the election and said, the ACLU raised $7 million in 2 days. And I was delighted for them. I am. The Anti-Defamation League has brought in hundreds of thousands, if not more than $1 million in donations. These are organizations that take legal action against those who would violate the rights of others in this country. We're not a legal organization. We're not going to file lawsuits. We may sign on to an amicus brief, but our goal is in bringing people together and helping them to make policy that's going to make for better life for individual Americans. We work on a very, very small budget here, and we have a very small staff. I would love to add people who can represent us in the field, going out to where we already have chapters in places like Tulsa and Oklahoma City, Denver, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Ocala, Florida, places that face challenges in their own localities, and to send people out to other places where Interfaith Alliance doesn't yet have a presence, but could, if some of the people listening to this broadcast would gather a group of people and ask us to send someone out to help them organize. That would be my dream, would be to restore Interfaith Alliance's presence to as many of the 50 states as we possibly can. I'm pleased to report we have a chapter in Hawaii, and I'm looking forward to going out to visiting them.
Jack, you've frequently invited listeners to express what their priorities are for Interfaith Alliance and what they would like to see you working on. If there's an example of supporters impacting the direction of the organization, that'd be valuable to hear as well.
So I've spoken on this program before about our mapping project for religious freedom, religious rights in each of the 50 states. We have opportunities for listeners to support that project, to help us complete the research, to put it in the hands of people in various faith communities who will be able to help us interpret that data, and to begin a series of conversations of salons across the country that are moderated by me, by other Interfaith Alliance representatives, and by people we'll bring in for that purpose. Supporting that project as it is very important. We now know that that mapping project in and of itself isn't going to be enough. We're going to have to maintain our watchdog status on religious freedom on a federal level as well because of who's coming into the White House and what representations have been made. So being able to monitor that is something that listeners can help to support by their contributions. We also know that we're going to have to pay much greater attention to policy in the months and the years ahead. And our staff is pretty slim on that. If we had someone who could devote himself or herself entirely to tracking the legislation and the policy pronouncements that will be part of the new Congress and the new administration, we would have a much stronger voice than we already do, a much more prominent place at the table than we already have. And your listeners can help impact that.
Jack, I'm curious, as we look ahead to 2017, I know you're thinking about it. Where do you expect the most important challenges to come from? What will we need to be focusing on?
Well, now I was privileged to grow up in a very, very secure and nurturing community in Wilmette, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. Most of my neighbors were just like me. Many of them belong to the same synagogue that I belong to. My high school was remarkable. I got an education that would be the envy of anybody in a private high school anywhere in the United States in a public school system. And I never worried where my next meal was coming from. I never worried if there was going to be a roof over my head. The issues that we face in this country right now make it possible that the children of the people listening to this broadcast will not be able to make those representations, particularly in communities that have become the new least favored minorities of the new administration. We have a special obligation in this country to stand up for the Muslim American community, a special obligation. As they wrestle with the authenticity of being a Muslim in America in the eyes of people in positions of great power and influence, we need to stand with them and assure them that they can be themselves. They don't have to change who they are, how they dress, how they worship, what they call themselves, just because they're being threatened from high places. That's our responsibility as non-Muslims in America. And likewise, we have to be very, very attentive to the needs of the LGBTQ community. We thought maybe we'd be fighting about bathrooms here and there after the election, but now it looks pretty clear that there is an intention to allow individual citizens of the United States to suspend the rights of people in front of them if they choose not to do business with them, if they choose not to welcome them into their houses of worship, if they choose not to sit next to them on a bus. So those are the top issues: protecting minorities in this country whose rights we had hoped had been secured already.
You know, we can't listen to what you've just said. Down my spine go ripples of fear and anxiety. So we can't hear what you've just said and not come to what I'm about to say now. Our focus today is on Giving Tuesday, which is coming up on November 29th. So, Jack, please talk about how and why people who are hearing this right now need to get involved in the work of Interfaith Alliance.
So the first thing I want to do is make sure that your listeners go to the website of interfaithalliance.org and take a look at our two Giving Tuesday videos. We have a wonderful endorsement from country singer Shelley Wright, who has a close relationship with Hugh Welton. You helped her in her decision to come out of the closet and remain proudly a lesbian of faith, which I think is an extraordinary example to so many Americans. She talks about the impact that you and Interfaith Alliance have had on her life. And the other is a video of me standing in front of the White House, in fact, in front of a statue of Rochambeau, who was one of the French supporters of the American Revolution, talking about our need to protect minorities and immigrants in this country. And I think once people have seen either one of those videos, they're going to want to click on that donate button to support the work of Interfaith Alliance, because that's what we're all about. And if that doesn't do it for you, at the risk of being a little commercial here, I'm sure all of your listeners have already seen the wonderful commercial on which Interfaith Alliance was a consultant from Amazon Prime, that shows an Anglican minister and an imam who enjoy a wonderful friendship and have a sort of gift of the magi moment with each other. That's the work we're doing. And that's why clicking on that donate button for Giving Tuesday is so important for everybody who visits the website.
Jack, I want to ask you a personal question. I know you well. I've known you for a long time. I know the kinds of things you enjoy doing. You've been a terrific rabbi in a local congregation. I want to ask you why you do what you do, why you've been involved in advocacy for true religious freedom for so many years and now are zeroing in on it in a way that you never have before. What makes you do that?
So here's the deal, Welton. Because you know me so well, you know how I am loath to introduce the Holocaust into discussions. I think it cheapens the currency when we bring it up all the time. But I can't talk about this issue without talking about my personal reaction to what I learned as a child and an adult about what happened to my people in Europe in the days leading up to and through World War II. I know how many more of my people, of the Jewish people, would be alive and thriving today if the neighbors around them had stood up to the forces of oppression and discrimination that started as words but wound up with guns and gas chambers. I'm not willing to allow us to approach that boundary in the United States. If I expect that others will do it for me, if God forbid anything like this ever happened, then I cannot tolerate for a moment that it would happen to any other group in this country. That's what motivates me. But I have to tell you, for positive reasons to do it. Because if all I'm doing is trying to eliminate hatred, if by some miracle I succeed, I've got nothing left to do. I just think there is so much to be gained by learning from each other, by experiencing the divine in this world through the eyes of one another, from understanding how people of faith and people of no faith find meaning in this life. I can't think of any place that gives me a better perch to fulfill myself than sitting in the chair I'm sitting in at Interfaith Alliance.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance. In addition to many vitally important initiatives, the Alliance is the sponsor of State of Belief Radio. Today or tomorrow, or definitely on Giving Day, please be sure to visit interfaithalliance.org and make your generous donation. That's interfaithalliance.org. Jack, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio and really helping us understand the urgency of supporting this organization so that it gets on in full strength with what needs to be done in this country. Thanks so much.
Welton, I'm only standing on your shoulders, and I hope it's not too much of a burden.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. So glad that you joined us this week. It's Thanksgiving weekend. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We really rely on your support to be able to continue this important work. Now, if you've heard something this week that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share that with others who might also benefit from hearing. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. You can also direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.